sermon today will be on the following verse from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 32:35. Their foot shall slide in due time. Oh, brothers, let me tell you, we are all walking on that slippery slope. The reason why we are not fallen already and do not fall now is only that God's appointed time is not come. For it is said that when that due time or appointed time comes, our foot shall slide. Then we shall be left to fall, as inclined by our own weight. God will not hold us up in these slippery places any longer, but will let us go. And then at that very instant, we shall fall into destruction, as he that stands on such slippery declining ground, on the edge of a pit, he cannot stand alone when he is let go. He immediately falls and is lost. Men's hands cannot be strong when God rises up. The strongest have no power to resist him, nor can any deliver out of his hands. He is not only able to cast wicked men into hell, but he can most easily do it. The use of this awful subject may be for awakening unconverted persons in this congregation. This that you have heard is the case of every one of you that are out of Christ. Amen. The world of misery, that lake of burning brimstone, is extended abroad under you. There is a dreadful pit of the glowing flames of the wrath of God. There is hell's wide, gaping mouth open, and you have nothing to stand upon, nor anything to take hold of. There is nothing between you and hell but thin air. It is only the power and mere pleasure of God that holds you up. And you children who are unconverted, do not you know that you are going down to hell to bear the dreadful wrath of that God who is now angry, angry with you every day and every night? Will you be content to be the children of the devil when so many other children in the land are converted and are become the holy and happy children of the King of Kings? Help, oh, verily, verily remember, this is a dreary, miserable world. Wretches of the world, unite. Help God stop that latte-drinking, brie-loving, French-speaking, baby-killing, gay-marrying John Kerry, or you will go straight to hell.
Reverend Danny. Now, except for the end quote about the latte-swilling, baby-killing John Kerry, virtually everything you heard from Danny, from Reverend Danny, the right Reverend Danny, was from a famous sermon given by Jonathan Edwards called Sinner, in the hand of an angry God. This was from a period in 1740 with the so-called Great Awakening in the United States. The original Christian fundamentalist movement. Now, we're sitting here today less than a week after the U.S. election. And a man was elected who can barely speak English, who is judgmental, is angry, who knows nothing, which, by the way, is a great American tradition, the know-nothing tradition. And you might be asking yourself, as millions of Americans are, how can this be? This is Jonathan Edwards, who wrote that sermon that Reverend Danny delivered. Next one, please. Now, how can it be? Of course, our Iowa guys are getting off easy on this one because Iowa is no longer a white state. But how can it be that except for the very top of the North Atlantic states, some of the Great Lakes states, and of course our great area of the country in California, Oregon, and Washington, and Hawaii, how can it be that this whole expanse, the red states, and by the way, this gives new meaning to the term Red Scare. How can it be that people in those parts of the country voted for this babbling idiot George W. Bush? Well, what we've seen is a shift from economic reality to so-called values, where people vote against their interests, people who are unemployed, people who can't afford health care, people who can't put their children in decent schools, voted out of fear that someone may come in and make their daughter have an abortion even if she's not pregnant. That their children may have to get into a gay marriage. What is this fear? What drives people? What causes this kind of ignorance? So that people will vote for what? Here you have a president who says he's against abortion. You know there have been more abortions in the 3.5 years of President Bush than in the last 4 years of Bill Clinton? You know why that is? Because the vast majority of abortions are of poor women who can't afford their children, who can't afford to be married because the person who impregnated them has taken off or doesn't have a job. So abortion is an economic issue. And yet the fear of abortion is a values issue that drives a whole section of this country. Now, to truly understand this, we're going to take a trip today into something called universal history. Now, all of you should be living in universal history, which means that when you look at the world as you get up in the morning, you're not looking at it as simply another day, but you actually have a sense that you're located in a process of the unfolding of the development of human civilization, and that many, many generations have gone before you, that what you do, what you think about, what you're doing in the organizing is shaped by this fight over time, over a long period of time, and that you know it from the inside because you know it through the great minds in history. Schiller, in his famous lecture on universal history, made a point which we should keep in mind because I want to caution you right now. What you're going to hear may make you a little angry to realize that people have been destroyed, turned into these so-called fundamentalists who know nothing of the actual Jesus Christ, know nothing of the history of this nation, and act foolishly. So you may be inclined to get angry and want to go out and attack fundamentalists. Or even worse, you may want to go out and debate them on religious scripture. Don't do that. It's not going to work. For every scripture you have, they've got 10. And you don't move someone that way. But you have to start from the standpoint of universal history. And here's the thing I want you to think about from Schiller. Schiller said from his view, and Schiller is one of the finest historians ever. From his view, he said, as I get older, I realize each day that there are fewer villains in history and more fools. And the question is, how do you change fools? How do you reach fools? And as Lyndon LaRouche has said recently, we've got a great ally in that. It's called reality. That you can stand for values only up to a certain point until you begin to realize that eating comes out of values. Feeding people, feed the hungry. That's in the scripture, isn't it? So what we're going to look at is this question of so-called Christian fundamentalism from a historical standpoint, from the standpoint of Schiller's approach of universal history, and from the prescience of Lyndon LaRouche in looking at this problem. Because what we see with fundamentalism is a large number of people who act foolishly. So how can we know what to do with them? How can we save the nation from this idiocy? Well, if you look at it from the standpoint of universal history, you realize that this is not a new phenomenon. That in fact, you look for the threads. Who gains from this movement? Who wins? You could look back at history and you see various heresies, various aspects of aberrations of so-called Christian thinking. The flagellants is an example. The Inquisition, which comes out of the same basic idea. But what is the underlying issue always? It's the nature of man. In U.S. history, we're going to look at Jonathan Edwards and the so-called Great Awakening of 1740. We're going to look at the Second Great Awakening, or the Great Revival, which took place in the 19th century. We're going to look at the foolishness right before the Civil War and the immediate post-World War I period. And then we're going to look at the outbursts of irrational, anti-scientific, anti-human behavior, which we see in the name of Christianity today. Now, what is it that causes this? What are they acting against? Most people who embrace so-called fundamentalist Christianity are doing it because they're running away from something. It's out of fear. They themselves may be afraid of uncertain times, of change. Change itself is frightening, especially after 40 years of a post-industrial economy, which is causing you to not be able to feed your family, have a job, keep your house over your head. So what's the response? I need my Jesus. Well, what we're going to see is that what Jonathan Edwards and others deployed against was a conception of man that was embedded in our Constitution. And to look at that, to get a sense of that, first we're going to look at this positive side, which was rebelled against by the so-called fundamentalism. So I'm going to have Ardina come up and discuss with us the positive Christian tradition that underlies our nation.
So, 215 years ago to this month, General George Washington celebrated and had the people that were the early colonialists at the time until then celebrate the first Thanksgiving feast. And before I move on, I just want to, you know, crush our ideas about Thanksgiving. Okay. This does not communicate anything about what's important about Thanksgiving. That communicates less. And next one. And even that really doesn't communicate anything about Thanksgiving either. I mean, the idea that you had the early colonialists and, you know, the pilgrims, the Native Americans living together in perfect harmony, singing merrily, you know, within the limited means of their environment, you know, environmentalist haven or something like that. No, that's not true at all. So just to give you an idea of what that was about, quickly, I'll just read this little passage. All right. The first Thanksgiving Day proclaimed by the United States called upon Americans to thank Almighty God for his kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, for the peaceful and rational manner in which we have been able to establish constitutions of government for our own safety and happiness, and particularly for the national one now lately instituted. So this came out of a century and a half long struggle, actually, here, well, on the East Coast, you know, in Boston primarily. So what we'll do is we'll jump in right at 1630, where you had a man by the name of Jonathan Winthrop, who was a part of this, what's been referred to as the transatlantic conspiracy. He came over in 1630 to Massachusetts, established Massachusetts, and, you know, the idea that they came over and they had no idea about the future and that, you know, the American Revolution was just some kind of spoof that came out as a result of, you know, them finally being fed up that the British had gone too far. The British had taxed the tea. You know, it's a ridiculous idea. You know, what you had was people like Jonathan Winthrop coming over and bringing, you know, the best in construction at the time, the best in tool making, the most skilled laborers, the, you know, construction workers, to hundreds of people, you know, on these small, tiny ships and came over. They had a clear idea of what they wanted to do, this idea of, you know, the city on the hill. And so one of Jonathan Winthrop's political allies was a man by the name of Increase Mather, who... well, I can't say too much about him. We've got to get to the point. But, yeah, Increase Mather, he was Cotton Mather's father. Cotton Mather was born at about 1663, about 33 years after Winthrop came over. And he was a Puritan. And Puritan is a form of Christianity that came out of Calvinism. And Calvinism had its problems. But we'll take a look at the way Cotton Mather thought about Christianity and what that meant to him, and essentially the improvements that were made on Calvinism by, you know, the Puritans developing this new idea of what the Puritans thought about Christianity. So we'll just take a look at that. Oh, show a picture of Mather. Yeah. All right. So this is... Oh, yeah. Mather wrote a lot of things. He wrote about, I guess, 450 or either 88 or 55 different published works throughout his lifetime. His intention really was to organize the colonialists. While, you know, there were people that were making sure that we were equipped, you know, economically, that we had the best technology that 17th century methods could offer at the time, Cotton Mather's intention was to make sure that the citizenry, the soon-to-be citizenry of the nation-state, had the most developed ideas at the time concerning man and their relationship to the universe and their relationship to their creator, which would enable them to be able to sustain something like this wonderful experiment, you know, to establish our republic, the nation-state, the United States of America. So I'm just going to read this first passage out of his book, probably one of the most influential writings he wrote, called Essays to Do Good. And this is something that Benjamin Franklin, and we should all be familiar with Benjamin Franklin, later on went to say was one of the most influential writings he's ever come across. And so we'll take a look at it. So this is the introduction to this Essays to Do Good. Such glorious things are spoken in the oracles of our good God concerning them who devise good, that a book of good devices may very reasonably demand attention and acceptance from them that have any impressions in the most reasonable religion upon them. I am devising such a book, but at the same time offering a sorrowful demonstration that if men would set themselves to devise good, a world of good might be done, more than there is in the present evil world. It is very sure that the world has need enough. There needs abundance to be done to the great God and his Christ, and more known to the service in the world, and the errors which are impediments and acknowledgments wherein men ought to glorify their Creator and Redeemer may be rectified. There needs abundance to be done, that the evil manners of the world by which men are drowned in perdition may be reformed, and mankind rescued from the epidemical corruption of slavery which has overwhelmed it. There needs abundance to be done, and the miseries of the world may have remedies and abatements provided for them, and the miserable people may be relieved and comforted. The world has, according to the computation of some, above 700 millions of people now living on it. What an ample field among all these to do good upon. So here you have a pretty optimistic guy, you know, Let's go get them, tiger. You know, seemingly, right? But if you just employ reason for a second and think about it, when you say that, you know, my intention is to do good, is to do good things in the world, usually if something, if you find something that needs to be done good upon, that means that it's either not good or in most cases bad. Now, if you have a situation where something is not good or bad, then that's usually a problem for somebody, right? Somebody's not comfortable with something here. Somebody's out of sorts. So the idea that you even have to do good presupposes that there's a problem. And one thing that we know, if we know about problems, is that in order to be able to solve them, you already have to be thinking creatively, right? You have to come up, especially for a problem that you've never been faced with before, like the problem to establish an American Revolution of citizenry that, you know, whose intention, whose government is to provide for the general welfare of the population. That, you know, it was a problem at the time that hadn't existed previously in history before, you know, and so in order to establish that your creativity is going to have to be summoned. That part about us which is not fleshly, which, you know, is made in the image of the Creator, is necessary. You know, is a necessary tool that you must utilize there, right? All right, so let's take a look at a couple of other things here. Okay, so he wrote a lot. This is kind of a funny book. He's got a bunch of chapters. I'll just give you the one I'm up to. The first chapter is like why we do good in general. The second chapter is, you know, doing good upon ourselves. He talks about not literal meditation, but the idea that you're always going to check in with yourself and, you know, make sure that there's a standard that you're holding yourself against that you're always constantly attempting to come into conformity with. And for him, that standard was Christ and the image of Christ. And, you know, we'll talk about that. But so this is chapter 3 where it's a chapter called Relative to Home and Neighborhood, how people should behave towards members in their households, you know, how they should behave towards their family members, husbands, wives. So there's a neat part in here, though, that I thought was, hold on, I'm looking for it. It's a part where he's talking to his children. I was talking about how one should relate to their children, and that if, well, I'm trying to find it, hold on, I don't want to. Okay, well, I can't find it at the moment. But I remember basically what it was. He says essentially that in discussion with, you know, your children, what he would want to have done is have his children, first of all, consider it a gift, a favor, not a favor, but a reward for them having done something good, having behaved well, to come and even have discourse with their father. And, you know, in their mind, they're going to be excited because they're like, yes, Father's going to teach me something that I've never learned before. You know, what a treat that is, right? And then he goes on to say that I will have my children fear to do something base, but because of the baseness in the deed that might be done. And I thought that was interesting because in a certain kind of way, you know, if you read this without being reasonable and thoughtful about what the intention is behind what Cotton is trying to get at, it's kind of like an Easter egg hunt. You know, you're kind of looking through all this Jesus, Jesus, Lord, Jesus, devil, Jesus stuff, and you're like, okay, well, where's the principle here? But, I mean, if you think about that, he has a certain confidence in his children's ability to be able to know that something's bad and fear doing something that would be bad for them as a human being, as a part of their personal development. You know, as opposed to this idea that, you know, you don't want to do anything bad because you're going to get punished. I'll give you a spanking. You're going to go to hell. You know, it's not that idea. It's the idea that, no, you can understand why something is bad as opposed to something being good and beneficial to be done. And that's, you know, that's a certain kind of it's a certain kind of faith, right? But it's a different idea of faith than you have with, you know, what Harley's going to go through. It's this idea that I have faith in the ability that God gave me a mind by which I could understand the universe and come to discover the universe and come to discover universal principles and universal truths. And that's something that was actually very rare, unfortunately, at the time in Christianity. In Europe at the time, you had a lot of religious warfare that was happening at the time. And it's funny because Cotton Mather gets attacked for this a little bit. At the back of his book in this appendix that he wrote, he kind of addresses this. But yeah, I mean, this is just an example of how different Mather was really from, you know, some of the cuckoos that were around at that time. So he says, "The occasion for this desire has been given by some odd insinuations made by some who express zeal for the propagation of religion, as if nothing had been done that way by the people of our profession who readily own, quote, that we are for embracing and diffusing the holy religion of Christ in its original purity, wherein his gospel has given it unto us without human additions and human inventions," right? So, I mean, essentially what you have is these Christians at the time, you know, saying, Cotton, what are you doing? You know, don't try to interpret the Bible or tell us what you think about the Bible. Don't write about, you know, what the principles are that you can extrapolate from the Bible. Just talk about the Bible. The Bible, you know, Christianity and converting people over to Christianity. What are you doing? I mean, you're just a human. So, I mean, Cotton kind of, he responds to this kind of gracefully. He says, "'Tis true, we have cause always to blame ourselves for our own deficiencies in such a work of God. And if we give an account of what we have done, it must be with a holy shame that we have done so little." I mean, so he addresses it, but in a kind of a classy way. Okay, sure, I'm not God. I don't profess to be God, but yeah, okay, whatever. You know, I guess he could have been more sharp on that. But, you know, this is the attack. It's not perfect. But, you know, this is the attack that was being waged on Cotton at the time. So, okay, so now let's take a look at, just really quickly, just like a couple more seconds, what Cotton was getting, right? What I'll use right now for the moment is just something that you guys are familiar with that the music panel was going through last night, right? Just the first couple of lines here. So you've got, Jesu meine Freude, Jesus, oh God, I'm going to butcher the German, but Jesus my joy, my heart's pasture, Jesus, my adornment. You know, Jesu meine Freude, meines Herzens Weide, Jesu meine Zier, right? Jesus, my joy. Okay, this is Fundy, right? Jesus, my joy. Yes, Jesus makes me happy. Yay, I'm happy. Jesus is my joy. You know, my heart's pasture. Yes, you know, I want to graze in your happiness because you make me happy. I'm gonna go after this happiness. Yes, Jesus, my, what most people say, jewel, right? Jesus, my jewel. Yes, you're precious. You're precious to me like a jewel because you make me happy. Of course, it's only obvious, right? So no, and so what? Jesu meine Freude, right? Jesus my joy. Okay. Well, we know if we know something, we know that there's something about this Jesus person that makes me not, you know, pleased in the kind of sense perceptual pleasure way. Actually, joyful. Okay, let's discover what that is for a moment. Meines Herzens Weide, right? The literal translation is, I guess, my heart's pasture, right? A pasture is where you get nourishment from, you know, where you get your food from, you know, where you have all the things that are necessary for you to live a healthy existence and grow and develop healthily, right? So this idea of, you know, Jesus being a pasture that you get nourishment from, okay, well, that doesn't sound like a very fixed idea. The Bible's pretty fixed, right, through and through if you read it literally, right? There's no really addendums to the Bible or anything. That's pretty fixed. But yet, if I memorize all of the Bible, what do I have left to learn? I've learned everything that there is to learn if I just go through and memorize the entire Bible. No, it's like, okay, obviously in the scripture itself, it's saying something about this. There's something more to be learned here. You need to learn, right? So then we have Jesu meine Zier. Right? Jesus, my jewel, is what most people say. But I think it's actually more appropriate to say the actual literal translation, which is Jesus, my adornment. Because I think it gets more at the point of what Bach actually was communicating here, but what he got from the Bible. Because the idea that you have an adornment, an adornment is something that decorates you, right? Whether it be earrings or, I don't know, necklaces or fancy watches for guys or something. Something that augments your appearance. Something that makes you more beautiful, right? And, you know, what Jesus, my joy, is saying, okay, what's beautiful about me is the fact that I'm made in the image of this creator. Jesus is what makes me beautiful, right? But when we think about Jesus, what's our idea of Jesus? It's not something sense perceptual. We've never seen Jesus before. We don't know what Jesus looks like. Some people think they do. Yeah, but, you know, we don't know. We haven't seen it, right? So, okay, what is it about Jesus that makes us beautiful? What kind of maxim do we have in our mind when we think about this concept of Jesus? And, you know, this is what Cotton Mather, what these guys were looking at when they were thinking about Christianity. And I just want to make one final comment here about a guy that also is a religious figure, I guess, but we're going to refer to him as what he more so is more truthfully, which is a scientist here, Dr. Martin Luther King, right? You got, I'm serious, you got King, who is in the tradition of the American Revolution, is a Christian, you know, does understand a lot, actually, you know, was fighting to, you know, establish here, you know, a closer approximation of the vision of the city on the hill that, you know, our founding fathers had, right, when they came over. So, but you have, this is what you have in science, right? You have science, you have this idea of someone being confronted with a paradox, right? And then you have a hypothesis of a principle that you want to test out and see if this is actually, you know, the missing ingredient here, the resolution to the paradox. And then, you know, you have the, whatever, we'll just walk through this. But I mean, again, just keep in mind what I said earlier about even the idea that you want to do good already presupposes truthfully that you're going to be utilizing reason, because when you do good, it's usually upon problems, right? So here was the paradox. King, an African-American man being born into the United States, where you had in this Constitution written beautifully, very eloquently, that all human beings are created equally. And that, you know, it's the role of government to preserve and make sure that the citizenry has access to their inalienable rights, the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? But obviously that was not happening at the time. So that's a paradox there. Is this true or is this not true? Are we going to live up to this standard or are we not going to live up to this standard? And so, you know, you have this paradox. And what he had a hypothesis about, King, was about a universal physical principle that he employed and demonstrated to be truthful called agape. Or, if you wish, you know, this general welfare principle in our U.S. Constitution. And what he did was he conducted an experiment. He put together an experiment that, you know, we know as the civil rights movement, and actually proved that, no, we all are created equal. Even sense perceptually what I'm receiving here, because think about it, right? Here's also the mark of a true scientist. You're not in sense perception. You're not dealing with sense perception. You're looking beyond sense perception to the principles that are in operation there. Because it would have been easy for Dr. Martin Luther King to make a similar hypothesis to the one that Malcolm X made initially, right? You're seeing, you know, people being killed, people being lynched, you know, people having firebombs thrown through their church, killing young, you know, girls as they're in church. Similar hypothesis, you know, white people are devils. They're evil. You know, I mean, you know, they're bad. It's the battle, you know, the ballot of a bullet, you know. This idea, he didn't do that. He didn't do that. He didn't go with sense perception. He said, no, I know something about this principle called love. I believe that human beings are created equally, and I'm going to prove that. And what he did, he set up the civil rights movement and waged a principled war that actually... It did, because what did he do? He got the Civil Rights Act passed, he got the Voting Rights Act passed, and he taught really the entire nation, and the world for that matter, a lesson about this principle of agape, this principle of love, of general welfare. That was his experiment, right? And so this is. I'm not going to pretend that I know everything about what morality is and understanding in totality, but, you know, I think that, you know, we're on to something here. There really is... fundamentally no separation between this idea of morality and science. If you're truly moral, you have to employ the same scientific method. It's the same scientific principles that are at work here. And that's what Cotton Mather understood, and that's why he was able to influence the nation as he did and organize, you know, as revolutionarily as he did. So...
So what Ardina has just given you is a sense of the positive side of the creation of the United States. The idea that starts with this conception of man as inherently good, innately good, but undeveloped. And it's the function of the institutions of men, both religious and secular institutions. In particular, in our Constitution, the idea of the general welfare, that there are institutions that will encourage the good, and that the good is something which is scientifically understood. Now, what is it that causes people to be foolish, to reject that, to look for something else, some other explanation? So what is it we're dealing with when we talk about this problem of fundamentalism? And I'm going to take a little bit of time to go through some aspects of it, but I want you to keep in mind this total difference. On the one side, despite the problems inherent in Calvinism, and I'll talk about this in a moment, Ardina hinted at this, there were problems in it. But the Mathers represented a different conception of man. Not that man is inherently evil, therefore we have to rely totally on God. But what does it mean to rely on God? The idea that you can build institutions of self-government which act for the interests of a whole nation, of a whole people. Not just yourself and your own concern with salvation. One of the central problems with fundamentalism is people who have lost this scientific principle of agape. Instead of concerning themselves with others, and isn't love thy neighbor as thyself one of the primary principles of the Judeo-Christian tradition? No, it's me, me, me. It's premature baby boomerism in the 17th and 18th century. I've got to be saved. Tell me how to be saved. Where's the handbook for my salvation? Instead of this idea of acting for the good. Now, as in the way it very often happens, Lynn had a prescience about this, which I'm going to call to your attention. This problem of the red state, blue state, the fundamentalism. And I had the privilege to spend a lot of time during this 2004 campaign, actually going back to 2000, the opportunity to spend a lot of time with Lynn and watch how Lynn thinks about these things and see how he unfolds ideas in his writings. From the standpoint of universal history, now, how many of you remember a piece he wrote back in March 2004 called Those Populist Fools Who Would Seek a Covenant, a Contract, Even with God? Some of you remember that. Well, what Lynn said in this is the creator of the universe does not negotiate contracts with so-called fundamentalists. And the background for this story, as Ardina alluded to, was the Little Dark Age from 1511 to 1648. John Winthrop came to these shores in part of what was called the Great Migration of 1630 to get away from the religious warfare in Europe. And what was the religious warfare? It was an internal battle over the question of whether it would be the church in Rome or individual churches that had power. There were problems with the Catholic Church. There was corruption. I mean, we've heard of the Inquisition. We've seen aspects of what was wrong with this right-wing Catholicism, which we still see today. But the Protestant Reformation was fundamentally an attack on the notion of Christianity. It was a gang counter gang, Reformation counter Reformation. And this was going on in England, a fierce battle in which Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church and set up his own Church of England, and the Puritans rebelled against that. And they took a little bit from Luther and a little bit from Calvin. But at the same time, you had great thinkers like Erasmus. Erasmus, who argued with Luther. And some of you may want to look at this debate over free will between Erasmus and Luther, where Erasmus said, yes, Martin, the church is corrupt. Let's fix the church. We don't need new doctrines that come out of thin air. You had people like Thomas More, the collaborator of Erasmus, and More was actually very instrumental in shaping the kind of thinking out of which the Mathers, Benjamin Franklin, and others came. You had Cervantes, who was fighting the idiocy of the Spanish Inquisition. You had Shakespeare, who was fighting the fallacies and the problems in Tudor England, the collapse in England that took place during his lifetime and begat the Stuart dynasty in England, which was a bunch of corrupt fools. So if you look at this, what do you learn from this? How do you approach it from the standpoint of Lyndon LaRouche? In this paper, he writes, The characteristic feature of the work of all these great Christian humanists, Erasmus, Shakespeare, and others, is the role of a pervasive sense of the personal immortality of the human individual. One can live through the severest adversities if one can rise above the perils of animal-like mortality to provide an active connection between the best aspirations of a long span of times before one's birth and also the future for all mankind, which lies beyond one's own mortal demise. For the fools contemplating such artistic souls, it is the poet who allegedly is the fool. But in reality, it is his critics who are the fools in fact, whose useless submission to the crass opportunism of their times will cause their souls to weep, as in the Inferno or Purgatory of Dante's Commedia, when the uselessness of their intentions is buried with them. And he goes on to make one other point that's very relevant for what happened on November 2nd. Under a section called The Rules of the Game, how is it that the fundamentalists have been duped? Listen to what he said. And I'm struck by this because I just wrote a book review on this. I've written a number of things in our publications recently. And now going back to this, I realize that what I thought was an original thought on my part was actually just fulfilling the idea that Lynn had developed in this paper. He says, the recent 40 years of economic, social, and moral decadence of the United States and the United Kingdom are associated with a special set of assumed rules, such as the conceits that post-industrial society is good and that wildly empiricist modalities in monetary action, rather than physical economic action, are the primary determinant of the improvement of well-being of the society as a whole. The effects so generated over the recent four decades have been precisely contrary to the outcome assumed by those who have adopted them and acted according to such arbitrary a prioristic or quasi-a prioristic assumptions. Such a saddening outcome illustrates the principal form of real-life tragedy in general. If the majority of the population refuses to face the virtually self-evident reality of that this present occupant of the institution of the presidency is not only a virtual babbling idiot, but is very mean-spirited and often sadistic person as well, and would even vote for him into office a second time, that people will have no one as much as themselves to blame for the consequences of their folly. Now, what I'm going to do in the remaining time is take a look, again, from the vantage point of universal history, where this irrationality comes from, to give you the tools and the ideas that you can use to free people from this millenarian pre-medieval outlook, which starts with the idea, as we heard in the famous song that everyone loves so much, Amazing Grace. What does it mean by grace? Well, it will save a wretch like me. That we are wretches, we are worms, cosmic worms, swimming in an evil soup called existence. And that the age of faith of Jonathan Edwards had to replace what was called the age of enlightenment. Now, we know something about universal history and science. There was a question yesterday about science and morality. Think about this presentation from that standpoint, because I'm going to give you the tools for a lot of follow-up classes on this. The idea of faith rather than reason. I mean, Martin Luther himself in 1521, when he was convicted by the church of heresy, Martin Luther, in his justification for that, said, reason is the greatest enemy faith has. She is the devil's greatest whore. Reason. So, this was the Reformation. Man is a wretch. So you had two false sets of conflicting axioms. The age of faith was a reaction against what? The age of enlightenment. Now, enlightenment sounds good, right? Lights, reason. Well, the age of enlightenment was an operation against the Renaissance, which was based on revival of Platonism. and Christian Platonism. The Enlightenment is Descartes, Newton, Voltaire. If you want to talk about the greatest horrors in history, that's a good place to start. And so the Age of Faith said reason is sterile. God did not just create these linear laws that you can verify empirically. And you know what? They were right about that, because Newton and the others were all frauds. But they said that to avoid sterile reason, we have to go with the heart. You have to go with what you feel, what you believe. It's belief that should govern your life, not knowledge. Knowledge is a conceit of man. The only one with knowledge is God. Now, just keep in mind that this is beyond the scope of this class, but the reaction to the revivalism was romanticism. To say, okay, you want feeling? We'll have feeling. And so it was a gang, counter-gang, counter-counter-gang operation, out of which our founding fathers went back to the best principles in human history. So Jonathan Edwards, sinner in the hands of an angry God. Jonathan Edwards' grandfather was a man named Solomon Stoddard, who fought directly against Increase and Cotton Mather, who did not like the idea that the errand into the wilderness was one which said that we can use principles and ideas to build a new great society. No, it was to establish the primacy of Puritanism, of a certain brand of Calvinism. Now, the central feature of this theology, or features, you start with the idea that Jesus is coming very, very soon. Now, you know, you talk to some of these fundamentalists today and they say, no, I'm not worried about politics because Jesus is coming. We have all the signs. You have people like Hal Lindsey, Reverend Hagee, the predecessors of the Reverend Danny who you heard today. And what do they say? They say, repent, repent, the end is near. Look at the signs. You have people interpreting the common establishment of the European community as the 12 crowned heads that will precede the arrival of Jesus. You have people in Israel, Jewish and so-called Christians, running around saying that once we blow up the Temple Mount, once we blow up the Muslim Dome of the Rock by these infidels, built by infidels, then Jesus will return. Well, people have been saying that he's coming for a long, long, long time. Reminds me of the Jewish joke of a poor schlemiel who can't keep a job. And so the town fathers get together and they say, all right, we'll find him a job. And so he's all excited. He comes to his brother and he says, I have a job. They ask me to sit outside of the gates of the city to be able to let them know beforehand when the Messiah is arriving. And the guy, the brother says, what a stupid job. And why would you take such a job? And he said, well, because it's a job that's going to be around for a long time. Now, the idea of Armageddon, the final battle is coming. Now, what are you fighting against? The corruption in society. The evil, the corruption of materialism. Now, granted, there's a lot of evil running around. You drive through our cities today and you see it. Some of the evil takes an obvious form. You know, strip clubs, casinos, and so on. Bars on every corner. And there is an aspect of the materialism, the lifestyles of the rich and famous, things of that sort. Every time you turn around, wealth is being promoted. Who wants to become a millionaire? You know, the Donald Trump so-called reality show. How can I get rich quick? But material, there is an aspect to material, the material world, which, frankly, we need. You do have to eat. It is necessary to feed over 6 billion people on this planet, to provide clean water, to provide power. This requires transformation of nature. Is this evil? Well, but if Jesus is coming, why do you need a power plant? Isn't Jesus enough light for you? And so what Jonathan Edwards argued is the spiritual over the material. And it's an outpouring of the Spirit, as we saw in the singing, the second verse, second time around of Amazing Grace. The Spirit took them over. It comes from the heart. And what does that mean also? Learning is a conceit. Knowledge is false. You don't need to know anything. It's the feelings of the common people which are important. Not the educated elites of Harvard and Yale, which is ironic because Jonathan Edwards was a graduate of Yale, as is our president. The common people who are opposed to the elites are led by elites, but they don't see it. Now, there's one other aspect of Jonathan Edwards which is important, the family affair. His grandson was Aaron Burr. Enough said. His other grandson, or one of his many grandsons, was Timothy Dwight, who became the president of Yale University and was part of the Hartford conspiracy to try to destroy the United States prior to the War of 1812. Now, let's look very briefly at this question of Calvinism, because Calvinism was deployed by the oligarchy. And you'll find a revival movement of the so-called common people is always funded by the wealthy. It may be talking about the importance of saving souls and getting straight with Jesus, but what does that have to do with free trade? You had a question, Cody? Jonathan Edwards' Great Awakening was 1740. So it's directly against... That's when Franklin went down and had been in Philadelphia starting to organize the revolution. Now, one of the aspects of Calvinism is that there is an elect. There are people who are saved by the grace of God, and there's no way of knowing who that is. Except there's a hint. The people who are saved by the grace of God are blessed by God on this earth. That is, they're rich. That everything they do will be successful. Today we can call this the prosperity gospel as preached by Pat Robertson. I am rich because Jesus has given me an advance sign that I'm going to be saved. And it's this idea that there's nothing you can do to be saved. It's the grace of God, not works. Cotton Mather, the to do good. You don't have to do good to be saved, Ardina. It's written in advance. God has a list up there, who's saved and who's not. Now, how do you treat people under this? Well, you have to free them from the evil nature of man. Man is by nature evil. Now, look, let's face it. How many of you here are probably thinking about other things you'd rather be doing than being at a cadre school? There's a part in the back of your mind. Or when you're out on a deployment. And you see a couple of bums walking around doing nothing, and you start thinking, gee, you know, why am I doing this? Aren't there other things I could do? I'm not getting rich, not getting any younger. Yeah, there is an element of our life which does seek that which gives us pleasure. It's called a comfort zone. And people can fool themselves into looking for comfort zones in situations which are not very comfortable. Essentially, it's a selfishness. It's an ego thing. What about me? That exists in all of us. But part of growing up and part of real Christian teaching is that as you grow older, you begin to concern yourselves with things for the society, with things for mankind. And you begin to get a sense of universal history that people have sacrificed before to give you what you have, and that your life is to be lived to pay back the debt to those who went before you, and to make a better future for those who come after you. And that's where the joy comes from. This idea that you're doing God's work. Well, what if your idea is that you can't do God's work because you don't know God's work? God is some mysterious being. And what Jonathan Edwards preached, what Calvin preached, is that nobody can know anything about anything except what's the revealed word in the Bible. So it's an attack against educated elites, people who think on science, someone who thinks you can know something. God didn't create the orbits of the planets for you to discover them. These are mysteries. Now, to go back to this question of educated elites for a moment, it's worth noting that Jonathan Edwards, as I said, was a graduate of Yale. But his favorite teacher, the person he loved more than anyone else as a teacher, was John Locke. On John Locke, he wrote, "I read him with more pleasure than the most greedy miser finds when gathering up handfuls of silver and gold from some newly discovered treasure." So it's John Locke, the egotistical philosophy of me, me, me. Now, Edwards' revival was funded by the so-called river gods. These were the wealthy traders who lived along the Connecticut River and who almost exclusively led the fight among the Americans, the colonists, against Benjamin Franklin and the American Revolution. Now, what ended the Great Awakening was the battle for the nation. That once people had this sense that they could build something greater, they actually could revive this idea of the city on the hill, that is, a city that everyone would look up to. Most of the American people were caught up in the American Revolution, and the best of the population, especially the best of the youth, joined with that old geezer, Benjamin Franklin, and made a revolution. Now, as we were consolidating the revolution, there were many, many operations against the country, and one of them was called the Great Revival. And the Great Revival started in the 1790s, and it went on and off till the 1840s, actually till 1857. And the central theme, again, it was man is a worm, God is unknowable. But it also introduced this idea, again, from Calvin, the Bible is the literal word of God. Forget metaphor. If it says that it's easier to get through the eye of a needle than it is, a camel through the eye of a needle than it is to get into heaven, that means what it says. Don't try and figure it out. Don't try to interpret it. Who are you to interpret that? But yeah, then for a rich man, that's right, to enter heaven. That's probably true. But this idea that the Bible is literal and there are no errors in the Bible. But these movements recruit from people who are fearful of change, who are being left behind. So the new evangelicals differed a little bit, that is, of the Great Revival, differed a little bit from the Calvinists because they believed that regeneration and salvation depends on one's inner faith. And what do they mean by inner faith? Get knowledge out of there. Don't clutter your mind with knowledge. That it's a common sense theology. I just want to read you a quote from a description of these gatherings in the 1830s where they'd set up tents and people would come from miles around. And so a historian describes them by saying, "With the full approval of the Lord, these grown-ups are shouting out loud and taking part in the wild, contagious Dionysian goings-on." That is, it was just chanting and shouting and as we'll see later, barking like dogs. And he added, "For these people being affected by these strong trigger mechanisms, the libidinal release will seem to be the absolute evidence of an authentic rapture." Well, what is the rapture? The great orgasm? And this leads to the, you guys got to face reality that this form of religion is pornographic. It's the idea that you experience some almost out-of-body, greater experience than anything through the infusion of the Spirit of Jesus. And this is why so many fundamentalist preachers are perverts. Just study the history. I'll get back to this in a moment. Now, the revivalism in the 1850s actually took off in 1857 after an important event in religious history. The crash of the stock market in October 1857. This religious event triggered a new wave of revivalism. It was also, of course, a moment when the nation was being torn apart. And people, instead of addressing that, ran off to tent revivals. And it was the true Christian religious leadership of Abraham Lincoln which brought the nation back together. Now, let's jump ahead to the next wave. And let me have the next slide, please, Marty. A baseball player who couldn't hit a fastball named Billy Sunday became one of the prominent religious figures in the post-World War I period. This was a period when the nation was going off into the kind of emphasis on wealth that we see today. The speculative boom of the 20s, based on free trade, deregulation, the possibility for the elite to buy up everything. And they hired a baseball player, Billy Sunday, who said, "With Christ, you are saved. Without him, you are lost. You are going to live forever in heaven, or you are going to live forever in hell. It's up to you, and you must decide now." And you'd have a room or a tent full of hundreds of people. There's Billy Sunday throwing down the challenge. You're either with Jesus or against him. For him or against him. And this was a growing movement in the 20s as people were losing money, as there was a collapse in the farm sector. Rural parts of the country had large revivals. Billy Sunday himself, by the way. Billy Sunday fighting the devil. Let me give you another hint about the theology of Billy Sunday. Billy Sunday was pro-free trade. He was against government intervention. He said, if you work hard, you can make it. He was the original compassionate conservative. He also, interestingly, after World War I, was anti-German. And this was a part of it. German philosophy, speculative philosophy, German culture, it's all the devil's work. Now, who funded Billy Sunday? Let me have the next one. Well, this is you can see in 1918, the huge revivals. They'd set up the tents, and you'd have large numbers of people who all came together as wretches. If you get a lot of wretches together in close proximity hearing about how they're going to hell, you better watch out for what happens to some of them with, but as Lynn often says, below the belt. But let's have the next one, Mark. Now, in the 20s, you had an upsurge in this. You had the Scopes trial. This was in 1925, where in Tennessee, Dayton, Tennessee, they put a teacher on trial. The teacher was teaching Darwinian evolution. Once again, you have gang counter gang. And he was defended by the great lawyer Clarence Darrow. On the other side, prosecuting him, was William Jennings Bryan, one of the know-nothing populists. And in the case, what did they say? The argument was that the Bible never says anything about evolution. Therefore, you shouldn't teach it. It's wrong. It's illegal. You know, this debate is still going on in counties and in rural America and the Texas school book fights today, things of that sort. But again, it's phony. You have the fraudulent idea of Darwinian evolution, that we come from monkeys. There's no proof of that, no evidence of that. On the other side, that 6,000 or so years ago, God created man. That's it. That's the story. That's where you came from. And so in the Scopes trial, you had the whole nation taking sides. And after the trial, or during the trial, William Jennings Bryan, who, by the way, was made a complete fool of, he was destroyed, even though he won the trial and Scopes, the teacher, was convicted. 5 days later, William Jennings Bryan, exhausted and demoralized, died of a heart attack. But during the trial, he said, the will of common people, when religion and science are in conflict, it's the will of the common people that should determine the outcome, not decisions by those with diplomas and college degrees. And so again, it's the idea there's an elite that's trying to force this anti-religious environment and force you to give up God and give up your religion. The same thing we heard today in the election. That latte swilling, brie eating John Kerry is going to make you stop going to church, make you give up your guns, and make you get an abortion. Now, in 1927, a very decent observer of American life, Sinclair Lewis, wrote a book called Elmer Gantry, which is about one of these sinners, a sinner who had no hope of salvation, suddenly being struck with religion and going out and leading tent revivals and impregnating women all across the Great Plains. Now, again, this was anti-intellectualism. And the movie of this is actually a fairly decent showing with Burt Lancaster playing Elmer Gantry. But I'd actually recommend that some of you take up the book and read it, because it does give you deep, useful insights into the fear of these so-called elites and their intellectualism. Now, out of the Scopes trial, out of the Billy Sunday, and there was another one. Let me have the next one. Now, this is one where you see Elmer Gantry. The spirit has entered into this man, and he's barking like a dog. This is part of the great cultural process of revivalism in this country. Let me have the next one. Then we have Amy Semple McPherson, whose Angelus Temple exists, I believe, is it in Pasadena or Echo Park? Okay. This was another one. Amy Semple McPherson wanted to be an actress and didn't make it, so she became a revivalist. Now, again, what we're looking at when you see these people is from the 1740s with the Great Awakening, the early 19th century with the Great Revival, the period up through the Civil War, then post-World War I, the idea that you have to strive for a sinless life and that maybe then Jesus will take pity on you and save you. Increasingly, that the world is coming to an end, so you have to choose now. The final judgment is upon us, and there's nothing you can do in the world that will save you. No good deed. You can go feed the hungry. It won't help you if you're not pure and if you're not born again. Now, this brings us to the period of post-World War II. Let me have the next one. Oh, actually, this is John D. Rockefeller. He was one of the funders of the revivalist movement in the 1920s. John D. Rockefeller, Carnegie, the Morgan family. Now, does he look like he's born again? These were the robber barons. These were the people who wanted to end any government role in the economy. They wanted free trade. Again, what does that have to do with Jesus? Was Jesus a free trader? Actually, he tried to regulate the money changers, you may remember. Jesus was for big regulation and big government. Isn't it interesting that the financial interests of John D. Rockefeller and this crowd coincided with having the little people embark on these revivalist know-nothing movements? For example, in the 1928, you know who the fundamentalists supported for president? Herbert Hoover, who was one of the richest men in the country. And in 1932, they tried to mobilize again for Hoover. Now, what happened to the 1920s revivalism? The Depression. The Depression came down so hard on people that survival depended on a change in economic policy, a change in government. And people actually became more moral by giving up their concern with their personal salvation and acting to try to keep themselves alive today. Acting to support Franklin Roosevelt, to go back to the traditions of the Mathers, of Franklin and others, who were committed to this idea of the general welfare. This was the change in 1932 with the election of Roosevelt and the launching of the New Deal that pretty much ended revivalism. And people became more moral. Why? Because they were producing. They stopped being consumers. They gave up their get-rich-quick schemes Today, if you talk to a fundamentalist, they'll tell you about Jesus and being washed in the blood of the Lamb, and then they'll go to the 7-Eleven and buy lottery tickets. So this idea of this phony notion of being good and sinless was funded always by these types, including today. Now, another one of these types who got heavy funding was a man named Charles Fuller. That ring a bell? The Fuller Theological Seminary. Charles Fuller had the first radio gospel hour. It was called the Old Fashioned Revival Hour. And later it became the Gospel Hour. And Fuller made so much money from commercials from these things and people contributing to it that he set up a theological seminary in Pasadena, where for the most part you have the cookie cutter pastors being ground out from this place. Now, let me have the next one. We go to these are the food lines, by the way, which replaced the tent revival lines. And that's another one, Weyerhaeuser, who is an oligarch up in the Northwest who is funding revivalism. Let's have the next one. There we have it. The young Billy Graham, who, by the way, is having a revival at the Rose Bowl, I think, next week. A big, big revival. There's going to be a stream of wretches marching on the 134 to come down to the Rose Bowl to be saved by Billy Graham. As you can see, Jesus saves. As my grandfather used to say, yes, but Moses invests. Billy Graham is another one who said, leave it to the market. Don't let the government tell you what to do. Now, much of this modern fundamentalism centers around a literal interpretation from the Gospel of John, where it said, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. And the focus on born-again Christians. But what does it come back to? Once again, literal, biblical literalism. The distrust of educated people, the distrust of reason. Gut instincts. And what does that produce? Well, if I could have the Reverend Brendan up here for a moment. We'll get an example of this from one of the largest selling books right now called The Purpose-Driven Life, which was written by a pastor down in Orange County. Reverend?
The whole thing, read all of
them? Yeah, everything, yeah.
Can you do like a 7 minute? Is that okay?
Hmm?
7 minutes? Can I do like a 7 minute?
Yeah.
It all starts with God. If you want to know why you were placed on this planet, you must begin with God. You were born by His purpose and for His purpose. You didn't create yourself, so there is no way you can tell yourself what you were created for. You exist only because God wills that you exist. You were made by God and for God, and until you understand that, life will never make sense. Life is about letting God use you for His purposes, sister. Not you using Him for your own purposes. How do you discover your purpose? Through speculation or revelation. What God has revealed about life in His Word. The Bible is our owner's manual. To discover your purpose in life, you must turn to God's Word, not the world's wisdom. You must build your life on eternal truths.
Again, what do we see? Philosophy. What the author of the Purpose-Driven Life, Rick Warren, Reverend Warren, says is that the problem with philosophy is for every question you answer, you get new questions. So there's no finality. You can never know. But God already answered everything. You exist for Him. And if you have a purpose-driven life, as he calls it, you can find happiness in your ignorance. Now, let me have the next slides, please. This is what you get, whether it's the Promise Keepers, whether it's a modern example of this, I am a nothing except for Jesus. Let me have the next one. These are victims. Don't be really. We have to look at these people as people who have been tortured, people who have suffered. We have to have agape towards them because these are people who have given up their own individual existence, their own sovereignty, and adopted this notion that you can know nothing. Now let me have the next one. The biggest know-nothing of all, President Dummy. Now, I want to read to you a couple things from what Bush reads every morning. He reads a book written by a 19th century Scottish Presbyterian named Oswald Chambers. The book is called My Utmost for His Highest. Now, Chambers comes from a branch of Calvinism, the Scottish Presbyterian view. And it's often said that a Scottish optimist is the guy that you go up to him in the morning and you say, "It's a lovely day, isn't it?" And he says, "Just wait. The world is dark, dreary, and miserable. And your life is one of suffering. Give yourself over to Jesus so you'll have eternal life. Don't try to fix things on this world." Now, here's some of the quotes from this book that Bush reads every morning. It's the only thing he reads. I think it's probably done in a special version for him, which has pictures of dogs and cats and Dick and Jane and things like that. But here are a couple of quotes. "If we turn away from obedience to God for even 1 second, darkness and death are immediately at work again. So if you're thinking of anything but submission to God, i.e. Dick Cheney, you're going to face darkness and death." Now, Isaiah talks about beating swords into plowshares, right? Isn't there a whole lot section of the Bible that talks about the need for peace? Well, according to Oswald Chambers, life without war is impossible in the natural or the supernatural realm. War is the natural condition, a Hobbesian world, the battle of each against all. Now, however, if you surrender to God, he says, if you obey God in the first thing he shows you, then he instantly opens up the next truth to you. Like, freedom is good, terrorism is bad. And Chambers warns you have to be careful of flesh and blood. He says, beware when you want to confer with flesh and blood, or even your own thoughts, insights, or understandings. Anything that is not based on your personal relationship with God, these are all things that compete with and hinder obedience to God. That's why Bush won't read a newspaper. That's why Bush won't listen to a briefing that disagrees with his preconceived notions. He reads this every morning. It's the only thing he reads. That's the president that we've selected. So we're in a moment where we are heading into a new dark age, where you had an alliance in this election between right-wing Catholic fundamentalists, the ones who hate the Pope, the ones who believe that it's a sede vacante, that is an empty chair, that there is no Pope, that the Pope is the Antichrist, and the true Catholics have to fight against abortion. And John Kerry, they said, is pro-abortion, despite the fact that Kerry repeatedly said he's not pro-abortion. And then they went to the Protestant fundamentalists, and they said, we all know homosexuality is an abomination, and Kerry is pro-homosexuality. Therefore, we have to vote against him. And people streamed to the polls, Christians, so-called, in hatred of John Kerry, in hatred of poor people, even though many of them were poor, hatred against homosexuals, and by the way, hatred against heterosexuals. You know, there's a famous saying that H.L. Mencken had about this Puritan mentality. He said a Puritan is someone who lives in the haunting fear that somewhere, somebody is happy. This life is not about happiness. It's about service. And that's the outlook that was grafted onto Bush with his compassionate conservatism. Now, to just summarize, the essence of this problem is ignorance. The essence of this problem is a rejection of the principles of classical culture, which is the central principle is you learn by confronting the paradoxes which exist within the visible universe. That you have to have a mind which takes you outside of the realm of the visible. And you have to be able to communicate new ideas, which require something called metaphor. It would be very interesting to hear what some of these people, like the Reverend Rick, whatever his name is, from the Purpose Driven Life, Warren, what he thinks about the question of metaphor. What he thinks a parable is. How are people supposed to know what Jesus was talking about? Jesus came out of a Platonic tradition because Platonism had spread throughout the area of the Middle East. And there are a lot of things in the New Testament that are not so simple to understand. If it's biblical, if it's literal, then how do you know what it is? Well, you listen to the preacher. And he can sum it up in two words or two ideas. You're no good, and give me your money. And if you give me enough money, I can defeat those satanic elites who want to have more government. So we have to fight this not on the basis of the Bible, but on economics, on real physical principles. And that's why Lynn's paper, it's the physical economy stupid, Lynn's idea rather, this conception, with the crisis about to hit in a more powerful way, the collapse of the financial system, the collapse of the dollar, where people need or are going to need answers to how you feed yourself, how you house yourself, how you raise your children. That the battleground is real economics. And that was the battleground that student of Cotton Mather, Benjamin Franklin, took up the fight in creating this nation. That's the battleground which is discussed in the Declaration of Independence, with all human beings having inalienable rights, and in our Constitution, with the guarantee of sovereignty of the nation, the general welfare, and posterity. And to be a true Christian is to look through universal history at this battle between the real fools and the handfuls of Christian humanist thinkers and take our lead from that. So that's basically what I wanted to go over, and we have some time for some questions. Well, actually, let me finish with the last one. I don't know if you can read it, but it says, Jesus of Nazareth says, give unto...
Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse who would borrow from you.
Okay, so Jesus is for handouts for welfare cheats. Jesus of Nazareth says, judge not that ye be judged. Jesus is soft on crime. Jesus of Nazareth says, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's. Jesus wants higher taxes. And Jesus of Nazareth says, what's that say, Marty?
Do not resist one who is evil, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other.
Jesus, soft on terrorism. So Jesus, wrong on social services, wrong on crime, wrong on defense, wrong for America. I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message. All right, so why don't we open for questions? Yeah.
Pornographic
Okay. On the question of pornography and the corruption in the church, isn't it interesting that the right-wing Catholics attack Kerry on abortion, but they don't talk about too much the question of homosexuality, given what we know about some of the problems in the priesthood? Look, the question here, when you're dealing with questions such as promiscuity, when you're dealing with the idea that ultimately what life is about is the pleasures of the flesh, I mean, it is the case, obviously, that what tends to happen is that the immediate sensual pleasure replaces something that's much harder to experience, which is a question of true intimate love, where you know another person. And the relationship is based on this idea of each of you working for a higher conception, a higher good. And that the question of sexuality in that kind of relationship is part of the intimacy, the fact that the two people truly know each other. And that sex is not a momentary pleasure or a release. Now, what if you walk around all the time, sin, 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 and you're trying to, you're essentially attempting to suppress the natural tendency of attraction. But worse than that, what you're doing is that you're relegating something which is necessary for the continuation of humanity, which, after all, there is a higher reason for sexual intercourse. It's called population growth. I think that's why Increase Mather had the name Increase. The idea you go out and increase the number of Mathers. Now, when you say everything with the body is bad, that the body is the vessel of evil that gets you in trouble, it's similar to what you have with Bush on the question of alcoholism. If you just stop drinking without dealing with the problem that led you to drink, if you think that the reason that you want to have sex with everyone that walks by you is because that's just natural, that's the natural condition of man, you know, the Freudian notion that we're really just animals and sex is just an animal act of pleasure. Well, if you have the outlook towards sin of the fundamentalist, that's what you believe. So you have to suppress that. Now, what happens if you're trying to suppress something that's natural, that's necessary, and also happens to be good? What happens if you try to suppress it? You turn out the horniest bunch of rage-driven lunatics ever. And if they don't have an outlet in sex, they'll go out and kill people. And so that's why it's said of the tent revivals, more souls were conceived than saved during the revivals. And in the book Elmer Gantry is in his early incarnation, he's a football player, just all the women are there for him, and he says, oh, that's sinful, I'm going to become a man of God. And he finds out it's easier to get laid as a man of God than it was as a football star. So, I mean, essentially, that's the problem. It's when you create this dualism. In fact, it's not even a dualism, because it's not even the mind. You cut off the head, and then you say the rest of the body's evil. First of all, we can't think because our thoughts are impure, because we're thinking about ourselves rather than Jesus. We're trying to come up with systems about the world. We should reject that. And instead, all we have to do is make sure we don't get our bodies seduced by earthly pleasures. In a sense, you're killing the mind and the body. And so the fact that there's an animal-like, a capitulation to animal-like instincts is just to be expected. And so there are many studies that have been done that show that people who spend all their time preaching against sex are the ones who think about sex all the time. You know, it's sort of like the guy who goes into the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist starts showing him the inkblots. And so the first inkblot he sees, he says, oh, that's two people having sex. The psychiatrist looks at it, puts it down, shows him the next one. The guy says, two more people having sex. And after he's seen about 10 of these, he says, well, I think I see your problem. Your problem is you're fixated on sex. And the patient says, what do you mean, me? They're your dirty pictures. When you have a fixation, which is what happens with this. But then what else? Since you're a wretch, since you're incapable of being truly holy, and the only way you can be saved is God's grace anyway, then you might as well go around and screw everything that moves, and then you just come back and say, God, I'm such a poor wretch, please save me. And then 20 minutes later, boom, you're out the door to the bar again. So I think that's where the problem comes in. Liz.
I'm just wondering, was there a faction displayed during the elections in the churches that was actually trying to fight those Catholic Great Movement and the Christian Bill Passes? There was no word from the churches.
Well, there was some. And the question of was there opposition to the right-wing Catholics, it was typical scholastic Aristotelian reaction. Ratzinger put out a memo which said that, yes, abortion is bad, but if you're voting for Kerry for some reason other than abortion, it's not a sin and you won't go straight to hell. Now, the basic question is this idea of the social gospel. I mean, do you organize people around principles of what's good for mankind? Or do you try to parse the literal words? And so instead of saying right-wing Catholics are enraged lunatics in the tradition of Torquemada, what they said is that, well, yes, Kerry is a baby killer, but if you want to support him because you need health care, that's okay. That doesn't work. And it's a problem within the church. And our job is not to go in and straighten out the Catholic Church. I mean, that's too much to ask even of God. But what we can do is take a look at the best thinkers in the Augustinian tradition, the tradition of Cusa, and what do you discover? Their notion is that human reason is the proof of our endowment by God with divine qualities. Because human reason will lead us to understand that there is a higher purpose to our existence. As opposed to the fundamentalists of different sorts who say, the only purpose of your existence is to die to escape this miserable, dreary world, so then you can be saved. And how can these people then criticize the so-called Islamic fundamentalists who say, after you blow up something, you'll be in heaven with 72 virgins? To me, the idea of 72 virgins is not exactly heaven. But anyway, that's another point. Yeah, Tim.
Well, we've all had like a run-in with these Christian fundamentalists. We've all had exchanges. And what cracks me up every time is the stuff that comes out of their mouth is so easily disproven by the Bible itself. I mean, like, quite literally, you pull out the Bible, open the chapter, and like the verse, you show them, right? But what you do, if you ever attempt it, it's really bad. Because once you show them the verse that actually contradicts what they're saying, the paradox goes right over their head. And they just revel on something else. So, I was wondering why exactly you show them, like in the book they worship, why they're wrong, but it goes right over their head. And why that occurs in someone's thinking,
right.
And then the solution is, like, how do you actually approach it?
Go back to Lynn's last webcast where he talked about the insanity of fundamentalism. What are you connected to? The insanity of free trade. You can sit down and show someone that every time free trade has been imposed, it's led to a growing gap between the rich and the poor. It's led to more cartelization or monopolization. It's led to growing poverty and misery. Do they say, oh gee, I guess free trade is bad? You can sit down and show someone that every time International Monetary Fund conditionalities have been imposed, It's impoverished a nation. What happens is you're dealing with denial, refusal to face reality. And in most cases, it's based on fear. Now, some of this is just brainwashing. If someone who has a degree in economics is pretty much as helpless as someone who is living the purpose-driven life. You know, because to become an economist, you have to get brainwashed so that you live in a world of money. You live in a world of phony curves, the S curve, they have a triple curve. It's M1, M2, M3. Does reality ever go along with their theorems? Maybe for moments. But you've got the same reason that people have problems with what we're doing with Gauss. Because they've been brainwashed that Newton and Euler and Lagrange, this is the nature of the universe, at least as far as the testing I'll get on it. So you get a Christian, they're saying, the test for me is, does Jesus love me? And the way I'll know that is I'll be saved at the end of my life. So, you know, you can't argue on the basis of the psychosis. You have to flank it. Now, what's the flank for a religious fundamentalist? It's reality. It's economics. And you're not going to convert them on the spot. What you do is you put a paradox into their mind. You get them to start thinking about the fact that, I mean, I think here's a very useful paradox. More abortions under Bush than under Clinton. Now, Bill Clinton is practically the Antichrist for these people. Their view is that, so what if Bush lied? Saddam needed to get overthrown. But Clinton, he lied. He said it depends on your definition of the word is. See, he's an intellectual who lies. And why does he lie? Because he wants to fornicate. So as Mencken said, somewhere somebody might be happy. Therefore, we have to oppose it. So you can't, look, you can't take these things on the basis of the religious belief. Tim, it's known as hypocrisy. And the way you deal with hypocrisy is you get someone to laugh at the fact that they're a hypocrite. If you simply stick a finger in their face and say, you're a hypocrite, you know, you're liable to get punched, or they're liable to say, no, you're a hypocrite. Or, no, I have Jesus in my heart. Jesus loves you. You know, or some non sequitur. But get them to think about the axiomatic basis of their hypocrisy. And maybe it'll stick in their mind. And maybe in the middle of some moment of ecstasy where they're singing Amazing Grace, it'll suddenly hit them that they're all gleeful and happy about being a wretch. And that maybe that's not what man really is. So you've got to look for the flanks. I'll take one or two more questions and then Phil, get Jack.
I was just hoping that you would comment on the atheist and the person's claim to be agnostic, because I think it's directly, in a lot of cases, related to this fundamentalism. I don't, my parents would drag me to church, and it just freaked me out that I have an anxiety attack. So I just said, that's it. I don't want any part of this. I hate God.
I was talking to someone earlier, I think Alexandra, who was saying sort of the same thing. And how many of you have had that experience? That you've been at a Holy Roller church or something like that, and that was it? All right. Well, the question is, atheism and agnosticism isn't a lot of this, just a reaction to the church. And, you know, the agnostic is the person who basically doesn't want to bother themselves with investigating a fundamentally scientific question, which is, what is the principle on which this universe is ordered? Is it purely coincidence? And if it is, then what's right or wrong? You know, this is the ultimate, the agnostic is the ultimate existentialist. They're saying, well, I feel strongly both ways, you know, where someone won't take a stand, and it's usually laziness or fear. And so they basically leave themselves in a position where they're saying, there's nothing in this world that can give you knowledge so that you can prove it. You know, it's like, prove it to me. Prove to me God exists. Well, you know, that's a hard thing to prove. It's a philosophical question. And immediately their eyes start glazing over. Now, atheism is slightly different. It's the assertion, the knowledge, the proof that someone has concluded there is no order. So they're already beyond that. Now, a lot of it is reaction, because look at all the harm that's been done in the name of religion. So a lot of people who say, well, I don't want to hear any of this, or oh, LaRouche the Christian, well, they're all no good, or you know, whatever. You know, the safe thing to do is to be a Reformed Jew where it's not really clear whether God exists or not. But you never, ever eat corned beef with mayonnaise. Yeah, Eddie.
I have another question on top of the question that I asked a couple of days before about Cotton Mather.
Yeah.
His whole role in Salem witch trials, because of this letter that I read, where he was condemning these women as like, you know, heathen witches.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to elaborate on his role during that time of the Salem
okay.
witch trials. And the second question is, what distinguishes faith and reason? And can reason and faith ever coincide?
Okay. Just I'll finish with this one. And Phil may actually have some comments on the second part. Look, on the question of the Salem witch trials, again, we go back to this point about sex. What were these witches accused of doing? Seducing men. Using incantations to make men focus on their genitals. I mean, witchcraft. Think about what witchcraft usually is associated with. The Earth Mother, the Earth Goddess. You know, it's about this idea that the devil is working through the genitals. Now, the point on the witch trials is there was an operation being run. And I actually don't know enough about it to give you a full answer, but I'll tell you what I do know. This was an operation against the Mathers. And the idea was to make everybody paranoid about everyone else as a way of destroying this effort to create this idea that you use your religious beliefs to do the good. Instead, you take people back to superstition. If someone disagrees with you, how do you know they're not doing incantations? How do you know they're not really the devil? And what Cotton Mather tried to do, actually I think it was Increase Mather who was most involved, but Cotton Mather tried to shut it down, make it a religious matter, and keep it out of the courts. Because they were afraid that what would happen is you would establish a precedent where you would actually have regular legal proceedings over who is a witch. So, you know, they tried to suppress it and stop it. And, it, you know, 20 people or so were killed, were hanged or otherwise killed in the Salem witch trials. It's a horrible situation. But, you know, think about the Red Scare in the 50s, communism. What you do is you take that which you don't understand or don't know and attribute it to the devil. Now, let me just be a little more controversial. The Catholic Church still has exorcists today because they believe in demon takeover, demon possession. It's not just the exorcist Hollywood style. These guys actually exist. And you have some of these holy roller cults, you know, snake handling things, and the so-called Christianity, which has a similar kind of belief in these things. So it's there. Now, on the second one, faith and reason. The only way faith makes sense is if it's based on reason. What do you have faith in? Something you don't know? So how can you have faith in it? Jonathan Edwards' argument is, you're going to fall into hell. There's nothing between you and hell but thin air, but you're in the hand of God. You're a sinner in the hand of an angry God. If you piss him off, that's it. You're going straight to hell. Now, how do you have faith in something like that? Give me the evidence. Show me the principle behind it. Now, on the other hand, if you look at Augustine, if you look at Cusa in particular, Cusa's writing on the learned ignorance, starts with this idea that we don't know the mysteries of God, but we know that we see the signs of them. You look in the heavens. You look at the way plants grow. You look at the geometry of nature. And you see the handiwork of some higher intelligence. So what is the purpose of your faith? It's if you want to pursue knowledge. You have faith, confidence, that there's some higher principle which governs the existence of man on this planet. And what did Luther say? Luther said, reason is the devil's greatest whore. if you think you're moving further away from God. So there's no dualism between faith and reason. Faith without reason is dead. It's superstition. It's manipulation. It's how you keep someone childlike and backward, like a peasant. See, I probably should have stressed this more, but the key point to this revivalism and the way religion has been used throughout history is as a tool of the oligarchy to keep people accepting their life with the idea there's nothing you can do to change it. You don't know God's intent. You don't know God's laws. Therefore, go along to get along. The worst example of this is what the church did in Mexico and is still doing in Mexico, where you have peasants who barely have enough to survive. They eat 2 corn tortillas a day. That's all they have. They have jobs. They work hard. And the money from their crops goes to the latifundistas, the people who own the land. And the people who own the land fund the church. And what does the church say to them? Oh, ye holy peasants, God loves you because you are poor. You may be poor in wealth and material goods, but you're rich in spirit. This was one of the ideas of the Russian Orthodox Church. It was the idea of the anti-Platonic current in European Christianity, both the Inquisition and the Protestant Reformation. The idea, don't try to change things on this earth. Live for your future, for eternity. And it's a doctrine that essentially says, you are not different than an animal. Live a life of a simple animal, and God will love you. Now, where's the scientific evidence of that? We do know that man can create through making fundamental discoveries of universal physical principles. And that creation can improve the circumstances for all human beings. That's the kind of God I like. And I think that's the kind of God that exists. But you know what? I'm going to keep exploring it. The educational program of the LaRouche Youth Movement is to explore this so you can know that you can make a discovery. And once you make a discovery, you know the process by which the human mind can increasingly move away from ignorance, move away from superstition, move away from being told what to think, and you can actually know as a sovereign mind for yourself what is true. That's reason. And that's the battle that Lynn has launched from the beginning, in the tradition of Plato and in the tradition of Jesus Christ and the Christian apostles. That's what Islam was about. The Islamic Renaissance had that conception. So in all great monotheistic religions, that tradition exists. But through most of history, it's been overwhelmed by a priest class that's run by an oligarchy to keep people stupid and living like cattle. Now that's something else you can talk to. To go back to Tim's question, you show people that their religious beliefs are the reason that they are oppressed and the reason they think they're wretched. And if they give them up and replace them with an approach to man, which is in the traditions of Mather and Franklin and going back further to the people Lynn was talking about in that article, that's how you change your life. So I'm going to stop with that. And do we want to take a couple minute break before you start, Phil? 10 minute break? 11:15. All right, we'll start again at 11:15.